Hello and welcome in.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Hello and welcome to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. It can melt the steeliest of hearts and bring a smile to the face of almost anyone. It is this sound. As well as making you feel good, the laughter of a baby is also a window into the development of children, showing us how they learn and build social bonds as they grow. My guest today is baby scientist Casper Adiman, lecturer in psychology at Goldsmiths University, who researches laughter and learning in children and babies. Thanks for coming in, Casper.
Hi, Carl. Nice to be here.
Yeah, it's really great for you to be here. And you described yourself to me as a baby scientist. Why did you choose children to research?
So that's within psychology, and if you've ever met adults, they're pretty complicated and hard to understand. So I thought, let's try and understand babies. Turns out they're pretty hard to understand too. So for 12 years, I've still been trying to do that.
So you thought you'd start at the beginning, but it turns out that's actually quite complicated.
Yeah.
Oh dear. Okay, so first off, we've got our question. And Kira, you've got that for us today. What do we have?
What is a phonogelia?
A phonogelia. Okay. Yeah, so if you know that, get in touch on us at Science Mixtape, and we'll have a look at the end of the show and see if anyone's actually guessed right, because I'm going to be guessing. I think phono, there's something to do with sound in there, but I don't really know. Anyway, Casper, we're going to kick things off with your first song, and you've chosen Cake with The Distance. Why did you choose this?
So I was trying to work out, and actually this is the first band I ever saw in London about 21 years ago when I first moved down here.
All right, well, here we go. Cake with The Distance.
Reluctantly crouched at the starting line. Engines pumping and thumping in time. The green light flashes, the flags go up. Churning and burning, they yearn for the cup. They deftly maneuver and muscle for rank. Fuel burning fast on an empty tank. Reckless and wild, they pour through the turns. Their prowess is potent and secretly stern. As they speed through the finish, the flags go down. The fans get up and they get out of town. The arena is empty, except for one man still driving and striving as fast as he can. The sun has gone down and the moon has come up. And long ago somebody left with the cup. But he's driving and striving and hugging the turns and thinking of someone for whom he still burns. He's going the distance. He's going for speed. She's all alone.
Birth to age 3 sees the fastest rate of brain development in the entire human lifespan.
Ah, so you chose the most rapid change part there to study in babies. Let's take it back. I mean, what generally, you're looking at kind of laughter and learning, but what is the role of laughter in humans more generally?
The best way to sum up laughter is this wonderful quote from Victor Borge, who's a Danish comedian and musician. He said, laughter is the shortest distance between two people.
That's nice.
And what he means by that is that it's a way of instantly connecting with anybody and a genuine connection. And a lot of social signals can be faked, like genuine laughter we can tell from fake laughter. And so we know that, someone is actually pleased to see me or not.
I've read that it's actually people can, even behind screens, can tell whether someone is smiling while they're laughing or trying to frown. Like, we're really attuned to that kind of social interaction, aren't we? So it's quite important. And laughter isn't really just restricted to humans, because it happens in other animals too. Like, how far down the animal tree does it go?
Well, this is utterly amazing. So wouldn't be that surprised when you find out that chimpanzees, gorillas, orangutans, all our nearest neighbours in sort of evolutionary tree, they all like laughing and being tickled. But about 10 years ago, a group of researchers led by Jack Panksepp discovered that rats also laugh.
Oh wow! And this is from tickling.
So they were eavesdropping on these juvenile rats playing with each other, like rough and tumble games. And in an ultrasound, so it was above the sound that we could hear. But if you phase it down with some sort of filter, you hear this like type noise when they're playing these social games. They then went in to investigate this and discovered, when they tickle each other on sort of the back of their neck, it makes them giggle, and this is an incredibly rewarding thing for them. So they actually found that it was more rewarding than food in experiments, that you'd teach the rat that come here and get tickled, and it would do that for
so as the reward of it. So it acts as like a reward feedback sort of pleasure center thing. Mm-hmm. So it must be quite inbuilt, and we know that everyone enjoys a good laugh. The comedy festivals are very popular, and everyone just wants to go and laugh. That's the role that laughter has in adults. Is there a slightly different role in children? Does it occupy the same role, or are there distinct areas?
I mean, so it's worth sort of separating out laughter and humor. So a lot of laughter doesn't have to be humor. I mean, obviously, the starting point, like something like tickling, is just a pure physical reaction to that. There's nothing inherently sort of humorous about that. And then, as I say, hugely important social connection to it. So for young children who don't speak and need to connect with us, laughter is a fantastic way for that to happen.
Yeah, and so in babies, babies start laughing relatively early on, before they have language skills.
Yes, way before language.
What kind of age do they start in?
So around three to four months is the first laugh, which in various cultures is actually a really big deal. So Aristotle said that was when the soul entered the body. The Navajo actually have a whole ceremony after you've made a baby laugh for the first time.
Wow, and so you were doing some research and looking at all these different times of when a baby's first laugh actually happened. This was with surveys. How did you do this?
Yeah, so we this is when I got started getting interested in laughter about 4 or 5 years ago. Just the simplest way to start investigating something in psychology is just ask people loads and loads of questions. So I did a survey, asked about 1,500 people all over the world. People with babies, what made their baby laugh, when they first laughed, the first smile that was like towards a person rather than just sort of instinctive things, the favourite games, songs, all these sorts of questions.
Brilliant. So we're going to have a little talk about some of the results that you had of that later. What role does the laughter have in the development of children? Can it be a certain milestone? You're saying that people celebrate it. Mm-hmm. Are there other kind of psychological development that you can see that when children are laughing, they are understanding something? Or
that's exactly how I got into looking at it. So I was already a developmental psychologist studying how do babies suddenly understand this new thing. We laugh when we get the joke, don't we? So yeah. It's like, is laughter a sign of understanding, a sign of aha, this is something that now I can comprehend why this is happening. And it's the first time I've discovered it, so it's quite novel and exciting. And certainly that seems to be like a little bit of a marker of what a laughter shows in babies. But as I went on, I discovered that, actually, even in babies, the social role of it is the important thing. And more, it's about holding your attention to keep interacting with you so that they can learn from you.
Yes, it maybe is kind of a feedback for a parent. If a baby's laughing, they tend to keep playing the game, right, that's making the child laugh. So how much of it is important for the parent as well as important for the child?
It's definitely, there's two people involved in any of those types of games. It is a signal. So I always think of it as the opposite of crying. A baby crying is very unambiguous signal that it wants you to do something to make that stop.
Yeah, feed me. Stop whatever's happening.
Clean me, whatever it is. Laughter is the sort of the exact opposite. It's like, whatever we're doing right now, I want to keep doing it, please.
So it's really important. Is there anything you can learn from babies that maybe don't laugh or is that common?
It certainly happens. So in the survey, we asked with the age of the first laugh. On average, that was 3 to 4 months. But there were some parents that said even by 12 months or more, their baby wasn't laughing. And this was like less than 10 out of 1,400 or so. And unfortunately, we don't know anything more about those families. We were never planning to look for that. We didn't follow it up. And is that something that's you know, just a particularly serious child, or is there something more to it?
Yeah.
We don't know.
I mean, my little brother, Rory, who may or may not be listening, but he just didn't laugh at all when he was a child. He just used to scowl at people. But, you know, he laughs a lot now, so he's making up for it anyway. So, Casper, we're going to have your second song, and you've got Woke Up This Morning by Alabama 3. Was there a particular reason you chose this one?
Yes, well... when you start hearing, I don't know if we've got the long version or not, but and you, Kyle, are also a Brixton person.
Yeah,
so Alabama 3 are a Brixton institution. They've been there for a very long time, and so sooner or later you end up bumping into them in a pub, and so Jake, one of the singers from the band, is a friend, so I thought, oh, I'll play their song.
Critical role in brain development in the first few years of life. A study called Sleep in 2008 found that sleeping less than 10 hours per night from birth to age 3 caused a higher likelihood of language and reading problems as well as ADHD.
Yeah, so it's quite important, make sure you get your sleep. Casper, how do you go about studying laughter in babies? Because it's such a, you know, fleeting thing. What are the kind of different approaches you have?
That's been a challenge all the way through. So the first place was doing this survey of parents, and then I had the idea of actually I would just go and find every laughing baby on YouTube, which I still haven't found them all. There's loads of them.
There's certainly a wealth out there, and some of those videos just make me laugh so much. Actually, in reading up on this show, I did end up in the YouTube cycle just watching laughing babies on YouTube, and it's probably the best thing you can spend time doing. It's just hilarious.
It shows that it's universal, and that was sort of just a way into sort of seeing what are some of the things that make babies laugh. And I actually had some people from the survey from my website sending me their own videos as well. And that sort of gives you a direction to go in. But then to get it into the laboratory, it really is quite a challenge. So we tried one study where we were, myself and the parent were sitting opposite the baby, and we would do laughing and yawning and see if the baby would join in with us. So obviously, quite fake laughing. Because like, oh, laugh on demand.
Yeah.
And the yawning, you know, actually babies don't get contagious yawning, so that was one comparison.
Oh, really?
And we could do that fine. And, you know, all adults in the room would, sooner or later, they'd be yawning. The baby.
So you nearly got Vigo there. nearly went.
Babies weren't surprised, but they at least sort of seemed like this is fine. When we were trying to, fake laughter, it's... as we were saying earlier, it really is noticeably fake. And so both me and the parent were feeling very uncomfortable trying to do this. Part of the experiment worked, but it really didn't feel like, oh, this is capturing genuine laughter. So we're still working on various things to do.
It turns out it's quite difficult.
Yeah.
So you had this survey that was on the first times we were laughing, what the causes were. Did you have any kind of main findings? Is there something that is just universal, causes babies to laugh? It was generally what people cause them to laugh first? Or?
So the two really big things which sort of are true across all babies, and that one of the first things, a way to make babies laugh, is tickling. So, you know...
Seems obvious.
But yeah, so 60 million years since our last shared ancestor with a rat, so maybe tickling is, you know, really deep down in our DNA. And that's sort of a very effective from, you know, 3 or 4 months on. But then the next one, which is also completely universal, maybe a few months later, 4 or 5 months, but both of these carrying on being really successful, is peekaboo.
All right.
You know,
This survey was across lots of countries.
It was about 30 different countries, primarily sort of the UK and English-speaking countries. That was across all these different places. Yeah, a guaranteed way to make your baby laugh.
So I've heard before that maybe that the peekaboo is kind of related to this concept of object permanence, where like a baby only really finds it funny when they realize that when you can't see something, it still exists. So even when something goes out of sight, it's still there. Is there a link between those two, or is it kind of not really linked?
That's it's not quite object permanence that's sort of interest there. So really, under about 6 months, yeah, babies, you hide something, their memory span is so short that they forget about it and really are surprised when it comes back. And that's probably part of the game earlier on than that, but it really takes off beyond that point. And part of it is for baby 6 to 10 months old, that they can predict that you're coming back, and they're very pleased that, oh, I thought you were going to come back and you did. But the game carries on being fun up until about like 2 years, and it's also fun for adults. We enjoy it too, and we're really getting out something that exactly the same as the babies are, which is pure personal connection. Peekaboo is, am I connected with you, or have I broken that connection by covering my eyes? And that's what really is so valuable and so rewarding for babies, is that this adult has stopped whatever else they're doing and they're attending entirely to me.
Yeah. So you've also done some work that looking at kind of maybe not just this parent-child bond, but actually bonds between children themselves. You were looking at laughter in groups of children, and you find that actually it's quite important in it, and whether there are children around, it affects whether a child laughs or not. What were you doing there?
Yeah. So this is an experiment that did work very well, actually.
Good.
So this was with toddlers in a preschool, and we were interested in this question about laughter and humour, and are they the same thing, and how are they related? So we made had the toddlers sit and watch a funny video, Bernard the Bear. I don't know if you know Bernard the Bear.
I'm not aware of Bernard the Bear, but he sounds hilarious.
Yeah, he's a very clumsy bear. He falls over a lot, has lots of fun adventures. So we had the children sit watching this. We had three different episodes, and they would watch it either on their own, in a group of two, or in a group, a larger group, about six or eight. And then we'd film the children and count how many times each one laughed and smiled within the sort of the 5 minutes that they were watching this thing. And just having one other person next to you increases the amount of laughter by a factor of eight. So you're laughing eight times as much in company. And, you know, one possibility is like, oh, the other person laughs, that sets you off.
Yeah.
If that were the case, you'd laugh even more when there was a group of six or eight.
Yeah.
We don't see that. We see that it's, again, a factor of eight over just a person on their own. So it's really when there's somebody next to you and something funny happens, your laughter, you actually laugh out loud. When you're on your own, you don't bother.
You're almost signalling that you get the joke, or you're kind of maybe in some way it's you're demonstrating a kind of social bond with the person you're with. It's a shared experience rather
than... Yes, very much, yeah. I mean, and that's sort of the success of going to something like comedy, is that, it really works when the whole audience are, on the same page.
Yeah, you don't laugh so much at kind of funny shows when you're at home just watching on TV, but when you're at a comedy gig, everything is hilarious. Yeah. So maybe it's shared from babies all the way through to us as adults.
Yeah, and that's why I have canned laughter on sitcoms as well, to give the impression that, or filmed in front of a live audience, to make you part of it being a real experience.
That's really interesting. So we're going to move on to your third song, which is 2 Minutes to Midnight by Iron Maiden. Did you have a particular reason?
So this is the only song I've got tattooed on my body.
Okay, right. Well, that's a pretty good reason. Let's have that. We've got Iron Maiden with 2 Minutes to Midnight. We'll be right back.
Touch early on can strengthen a baby's neural connections and greater overall well-being. Children who receive more nurture have thicker hippocampuses than those who are deprived of touch as babies.
So more neural connections, and that's kind of related to what we're going to be talking to about now, which is that you're looking at, so this is all related, right? So we just had 2 minutes to midnight, mm-hmm. And you have a tattoo which has a clock which is at 2 minutes to midnight, and this is because you're doing research into time perception. But this is also related to kind of trying to build neural networks that try and mimic this perception. Is that right?
Yeah, all of those things are true.
So how is this related?
So yeah, as well as looking at laughter, look at all sorts of things that babies can do and that adults can do. One of the reasons for looking at babies is to try and understand the adult ability. And one area of research that I got involved in was, well, how does the brain tell the time? What's the mechanism behind that? The old explanation used to be that there's a little clock ticking away. There's some sort of oscillator inside the brain that, and then something else that counts up, tick, 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 tick.
Right.
If you have something like that, it's way more accurate than the actual ability to judge the time. We're terrible at judging the time.
Yeah.
So that's not the explanation. And we thought, well, let's look at babies and try and build computer models that neural network models that sort of mimic the brain in a way that might give us a better explanation.
Do you have a better explanation?
We think we do, yeah. And so the starting point is that actually when we tested babies on whether they have a sense of time, and this is for like short intervals, so judging whether the chorus on that song was 20 seconds long or 30 seconds long, approximately how long did you think it was. With babies, we had a little teddy bear that popped up on the screen every 3 seconds or every 5 seconds. Do they look back at the right time?
Right.
And we're actually, our errors in that grow linearly. So if you're judging an interval that's about 5 seconds long, your errors, let's say it's 3 seconds. On an interval that's 10 seconds, your errors would be about 6 seconds.
Right.
So we get bad. Whereas if you had a clock, you'd actually get better with longer intervals because the sort of the noise in it would cancel itself out.
Right.
So law of large numbers.
You get closer to the right answer just because of the number of tries you have.
Yeah. And that's not what happens. What happens is we're really bad at it. So we looked at what else. Could we do? What else is there in the brain that's happening that you could use as a signal for time? The other thing was nobody ever found one of these clocks in the brain. There aren't oscillators that do that sort of thing. So we decided, well, what are you doing in judging time? You're looking to sort of into your memory to sort of access what can I say about that object? Actually, if you think the longer ago something was, the fuzzier your memory of it would be.
Right.
And we decided that picking that measure of fuzziness might be a good proxy for how long ago it was. Two seconds after something happens, it's really crystal clear. Your brain sort of says, yeah, I remember all the details of that. That's recent. And the further back in time it is, the more uncertainty there is about it, and your brain says that uncertainty equals the length of time.
Oh, that's really interesting. It's kind of like the memory slowly decaying, and by how much it's decayed, that's an idea of how long ago it was.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. So we're going to move on to your next song, but you have a very specific song which you've chosen, which is in very, very closely linked to your research, and it's called The Happy Song, by Imogen Heap. How did you develop this? How were you involved?
Yeah, so this we helped make this song. This is the first scientifically tested song created to make babies happy. We made this last summer. A baby company called C&G Baby Club came and said, right, we want to make babies happy. We want to give some parents a part of our club to make their babies, you know, cheerful. They came to me. I'm obviously a scientist who studies the laughing babies. Two doors down from me is Professor Lauren Stewart, who's a professor of the psychology of music. Right. And she's done a lot of research on like songs that get stuck in your head. So they've got this horrible name, earworms.
Yeah.
And so they're like, oh, right, we'll put you two together. Tell us the science behind what makes a catchy song and what makes babies happy. So we started looking at everything that anybody else had done. So, yeah, we're confident, but yeah, we can't write it. So they went out and found Imogen, who is like, she's got a first woman to ever get a Grammy for music production. Yeah. So she's really a tech loving, a really geeky musician. And so she's like keen on the science. And she had a daughter who was about 18 months old at the time. So they got her on board. It's like, can you help, you know, help us write?
She had
song?
Both the knowledge and the drive to make a song that's making a baby happy.
Yeah, yeah, with science.
Exactly. And so, what kind of things did you consider? What was important in making a song that induced laughter in babies?
So there's obviously some of them in music elements. So it has to be quite up tempo and in a major key. With a female voice singing, babies obviously like female voices. From the laughter point of view, we wanted to put lots of things in which are very social. So we wanted it to be a song that parents could sing and interact with their babies. So the lyrics are sort of lots of elements which you can do actions for and that you can do with the baby. There's a few sort of funny noises. So we did a big survey asking, I think we asked about 2,500 parents the funniest noises, and those are obviously like raspberries and other babies laughing, silly noises. So we could work those in. Surprise. So there's bits of the song where there's long slides up to something happening. Imogen mixed all of these together. And then we tested various versions of these on babies in the lab and see which one. Initially we had four different melodies. One was clearly like way more popular than all the others with the baby, so that became the basis of the song. Built the whole song, tested that again, changed a few little details, and I think it's now up to about 8 million views on YouTube, so
well, yeah.
Maybe we did it right.
Clearly it's being loved by someone. So here it is. This is The Happy Song by Imogen Heap in collaboration with our guest today, Casper Adiman.
To leave a parent signals the development of long-term memory.
Science.
News.
Moths could munch away our plastic problem.
Good news about alien hunting.
Microfiber sensor for real-time healthcare monitoring.
Quantum computer up to 50 qubits.
Potential new treatment for ALS.
Okay. I remember ALS. That was the bucket, ice bucket challenge thing, right? So what's happened? They've actually been successful. They've managed to get something close to a cure anyway.
Yeah, something close to a cure. So not quite full cure, but something with huge potential here. So in the University of Montreal, they've been doing some experiments on genetically modified worms and zebrafish and mice, which have symptoms of ALS, using a drug which was previously known to treat schizophrenia called pimazide. And it's been shown huge potential to preserve the paralysis known in ALS by preserving the neuromuscular junction. And actually some human clinical trials have also been carried out with very promising results. And phase two clinical trials are due to start very soon. So hopefully this could be a very good treatment for people with ALS.
So this is something that's going to kind of hold back the symptoms. So it's a cure, it kind of stops the progression of it.
Stop the progression, yeah. So they could potentially have a longer lifespan and just a greater quality of life, really.
That's great. I mean, they're working towards a cure. I had something on plastics, which is that apparently moths can eat our plastics. Well, that's a bit of a stretch, but what they've found is that there are certain types of moths, and these are these Indian meal moths. They just like, you know, general pests that you find in your house. They like to eat flour and grain and stuff like that. And it turns out that the larvae of these moths were able to digest polyethylene plastic, and that's used for carrier bags and other packaging. And so some researchers at Texas Tech University in Lubbock, they fed some of these moth larvae a plastic diet to find out how they manage. And it turns out the digestive bacteria in the guts of these moths has large populations of this other bacteria called Tepidemonas Pseudomania rhizobialis and Methylobacteriaceae.
Wow, that's quite a mouthful.
I did have to practice those, and I probably got most of them wrong. But anyway, they had these populations of bacteria compared to the ones that were fed on just like a grain diet. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is that maybe that coating these plastics in these kind of bacteria could help speed up decomposition that's caused by other things out there. It's pretty mean. And last week, Ian McDonald, who was on, told us about the fact that coral eats plastic as well, and they couldn't digest it. But it turns out that these moths can actually digest it and do the same. So there's hope yet. Wow. Casper, you were looking at the research for the Arecibo telescope, which has been renewed, right?
Yeah, so there's two bits of really good news about giant radio telescopes. So the Arecibo dish is the famous one in Puerto Rico. It's in the James Bond film where he ends up destroying it. And in the alien hunting film Contact with Jodie Foster. So that was under threat. And then the National Science Foundation announced a few days ago that they will keep funding it. So it's one of the few things that that Trump hasn't actually cut. And it will keep hunting for aliens.
Oh, that's so good. So it's these massive telescopes that actually can end up leading to some out there discoveries.
Yeah, so that was the biggest in the world. But now also opening for relatively recent is something called the FAST telescope in Guizhou province in China, which stands for 500 meter aperture spherical telescope.
Wow.
And so that's four times the size of the Arecibo receiver.
Gosh. This is getting... They're running out of names now, right? Because there was the large telescope, the very large telescope, the extremely large telescope. No, just what are you going to go to next? So, Kira, we've got something else. What about microfibers sensing? What was this?
Yeah, so scientists at the National University of Singapore developed a microfiber sensor, which is really, really tiny. It's about the same width as a human hair strand. And it basically just sits on the skin and can measure your pulse. And so then doctors can just use this, and they have a monitor, kind of like an app, which just pops up real-time updates of people's pulses. And then this pulse measurement can be used to measure heart rate and blood pressure and stiffness of the blood vessel. So it would actually save doctors a huge amount of time, and they wouldn't have to be running around with loads of different equipment to every single patient. And also they think that it could have huge benefits for people with atherosclerosis, which is a buildup of plaque in the blood vessels causing heart attack and stroke and that kind of thing. So the buildup of plaque would actually cause a change in a person's pulse over time.
Okay, so it can be monitored.
Yeah, and this could be measured by this microfiber sensor. And so they might actually, instead of detecting this using MRI scans, which are very costly and take up a huge amount of time and require medical practitioners, you could just have this microfiber sensor at home with you all the time, and it would detect a buildup of plaque, and then you could go to the doctor and be like, I think I might need help.
Might need help because I'm having a heart attack. Yeah, no. Oh, brilliant. Wow. So we're going to squeeze one more thing in, which is something that I have read about, the quantum computing, which is something that I'm kind of studying as well. And this IBM have announced they're testing a new prototype quantum computer with 50 qubits. And so quantum computers use these qubits. They're kind of analogous to bits of ones and zeros in a normal computer. But the state of the qubit is quantum mechanical, and so the computations are fundamentally different. They can answer questions that normal computers can't, and maybe this means that the age of quantum computing is approaching quite rapidly.
Yeah, I love the pictures of that machine. It's like so steampunk, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like all these gold and silver and brass, you know, yeah, tubes
it has to be very, very cold to work, yeah. And so like that, the whole apparatus
that's
is like just to get it down to like, you know, very, very small temperatures, the millikelvin temperatures. But it's amazing. They're really leading the way on this. Okay, so we're going to have your fifth song now, Casper, which is Roots Maneuver with Awfully Deep. Why'd you choose this?
So this is in the other direction from Brixton. So Roots Maneuver is from Stockwell, and he's the godfather of British hip hop. The national anthem of British hip hop is one of his songs, but I thought I'd play this one, which is a bit more interesting.
Awfully deep, I can't get no sleep. Things are getting awfully deep. Awfully deep, I can't get no sleep. Things are getting awfully deep. Awfully deep, I can't get no sleep. Things are getting awfully deep. Awfully deep, awfully deep. I don't do mind games, I'm frame by frame. I'm 18 hits, I'm 48 hertz. My favorite tie to my dick it hurts. My flirt tactics are so down sublime. My long john greets the slippery slime. My prime cut, move the butt, twist your nuts. From you don't know, itch then keep your mouth shut. I'm hot one, hot two, hot three and hot four. A terrible phase of spelling.
The science of laughing and its effects on the body are referred to as gelotology.
Well, there you go. So we were just talking that might be a little bit of a hint for the question we had at the top. But anyway, Casper, we've been talking a lot about this laughter, you know, research into laughter and learning. And do you think that this can have kind of therapeutic or medical effects? You know, figuring out why people laugh can help improve many sorts of other things.
I mean, it's certainly, makes you cheerful, doesn't it?
It really does, yeah.
So, from a purely physical level, certainly the whole theory behind people who do laughter yoga is that the physiological effects of laughter are quite beneficial. It's, you know, quite good for you to sort of be in that state. There's not much sort of strong research evidence behind that. We've wanted to look at sort of the hormonal effects of laughter on babies. Does it make them sort of more alert and then ready to learn? There are some studies which have thought that when you're in a laughing situation, you are learning better. And then, you know, if there is this social connection, things which learn teach you how to promote that are very, you know, must be beneficial for young children.
Yeah, definitely. What kind of things are you up to now? Have you got experiments kind of in the pipeline or things you've just finished?
Yes. Yeah, so the next really big thing we want to do is to look at what is it about infant-directed speech when you're talking to a baby. We all talk like this, don't we? Hello, how are you? A little bit of research has discovered that that's sort of universal across languages. The way that we change our voice is the same in all languages. And we're interested in why that might be. So we're working with a team from Paris who are music engineers, and they can actually, in real time, change your voice to make you sound more happy or more anxious, all sorts of things.
Wow, that is amazing and terrifying.
So we're going to see if is that what speech to babies is. Is it just a happier version of the way you would normally speak?
Okay, so that's a question that you're still to be answered. Yeah, to be answered in the future.
That, yeah.
Okay, so how can people find out more about your research or get involved? I know you're always kind of looking for people to take part. And
yeah, so we're the Infant Lab at Goldsmiths is where I do this research. And so if anybody in the South London area with a young baby, just go onto our website, Google that, you'll find it. We're always looking for young babies to come in and help with their studies. If you're not sort of in that immediate area, then you want to look on my other website, babylaughter.net, which has got stuff about the actual laughter studies.
And so this is, you can take part in the survey. Is that still going? Or is
The survey isn't going at the moment. We may have a new one coming out in January or February, but they can always be sending us videos of their laughing babies.
Yeah, and just please put those on YouTube because I'd love them so much. So thanks for coming in, Casper. It's been really great to talk to you. We've got time to go back to our question that we had at the top of the show. What was that, Kira?
So what is a phonogelia?
Okay, so I think it's not being able to hear something, maybe.
Yeah, I was kind of guessing maybe something to do with gelato. But
ice cream. Yeah. It's a fear of noisy ice cream. That's what I mean. What actually is it?
So it's a very rare neurological condition whereby the sufferer is unable to laugh out loud. Yeah, I've never met anyone with this
condition.
I've
never met anyone, no. That's a real shame. Yeah. That would be a terrible thing. So, again, thanks for coming in, Casper. It's been really great chatting. I've been Kyle Major. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, and come in again when we've got some more laughter to talk about. I've been Kyle Major. Our producer today was Kira Mulhern. We go out live on Soho Radio every Saturday morning, 10 a.m. If you missed that, you can listen again to the podcast version, available on all half-decent podcast providers. If you like the show, why not get in touch? We're on Twitter. Can be found by the handle @ScienceMixtape. I thank our guest, Casper Adamant, one last time. And we'll go on his final choice, which this time is Sue Jorge and Life on Mars.
Exactly.
Any particular reason?
Just play it and I think you'll see.
Oh. Okay, well, thank you and goodbye.
E a mente não faz questão e nem tem forças pra obedecer. Quantos sonhos já destruí e deixei escapar das mãos. Se o futuro assim permitir, não pretendo viver em vão. Meu amor, não estamos sós, tem um mundo a esperar por nós.